This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on November 15, 2012. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Thursday, November 15, 2012, will come to order. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes for October 18, 2012. Madam Vice Chair, do you have a motion?
I do. I move that we approve the minutes for the open meeting of October 18, 2012, as set forth in agenda document number 12-76.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it 6-0. Madam Vice Chair, we have a few late submitted documents.
We do. I would like to take a moment before I make the motion, though, to note the passing of a significant event in campaign finance land. Apparently, Stephen Colbert filed for termination of his super PAC, Americans for a Better Tomorrow, this week. I know I'm going to miss it.
Had you contributed to it?
I had not. No, I don't make contributions to any kind of PACs. But I do think that it was it's a challenge to make what we do entertaining as well as informative. And Godspeed, Stephen. We'll miss you. I hope this doesn't mean that Trevor Potter is now unemployed. In any event, we do have late submitted documents. Pardon me for that moment of frivolity. I move that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider agenda documents 12-79, 12-69C, 12-78, and 12-78A.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it 6-0. Thank you. The next matter on the agenda is the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee request to modify conciliation agreement in MER 3620. Mr. Elias has kindly joined us this morning, and without objection, we have a few questions for you, Mr. Elias.
Madam Chair, before we proceed, I'd like to mention the fact that I did have a telephone conversation with Mr. Elias yesterday regarding this matter.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Ms. Lee has a brief presentation
for
the Commission.
Ms. Lee, thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioners. MER 3620, initiated over 20 years ago, concerns allegations that the DSEC violated the earmarking provisions of the Federal Election Campaign Act and Commission regulations. The complaint in this matter specifically alleged that the DSEC's tally program, which allowed an individual donor to tally a contribution to the DSEC in the name of a particular senatorial candidate, resulted in illegal excessive earmark contributions to such candidate. In 1995, the DSEC and the Commission entered into a conciliation agreement to resolve the allegations. The DSEC has now submitted a request to modify the agreement. The DSEC specifically requests that the Commission modify the provisions that require the DSEC to undertake certain ongoing remedial provisions. These measures are subject to no time limit. These measures include refunding or forwarding contributions that appear to be earmarked, providing additional education and training to staff regarding earmarking and tally contributions, implementing procedures to ensure that solicitations for the tally program could not be read to solicit earmark contributions, and including in all solicitations for the tally program a disclaimer that the DSEC does not accept earmark contributions. We conclude that under the unique circumstances presented in this matter, the DSEC has demonstrated that continued enforcement of the remedial provisions of the agreement is no longer warranted. Accordingly, we recommend that the Commission find that the DSEC has fulfilled its obligations of the agreement and that it is relieved from satisfying the ongoing remedial measures.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. We have Mr. Elias and Mr. Burkham with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry about this. This is a little. There's tape that seems to be giving way. I kid you not. Scotch tape. I thank you for having us.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
I agree for the most part with the memo that the general counsel has put together, but I want to make sure I understand. There's one part I'm not sure about, and it's a question perhaps for general counsel's office, perhaps for Mr. Elias, because it may turn more on what your client was doing, why the FEC thought it was a problem, and why it's not a problem anymore. The thing that got my attention on page 5 of the general counsel's memo, first full paragraph, actually it's first paragraph, it's the third, the fact that the agreement requires the DSCC to refrain from conduct that is no longer unlawful weighs heavily in favor of a commission determination that the DSCC's ongoing obligations under the agreement should end. I understand the argument that back in the day you had soft money and other issues that are no longer present post McCain-Feingold. What I'm trying to figure, what's no longer unlawful about, what's the change here? Because earmarking is still a problem. If you go out and solicit a donor and say, give the DSCC money so I can turn around and give it to Senator X, that's a classic earmark. Right, you're not suggesting that that's what you're going to do in any way, shape, or form. This is more of a generalized fundraising thing. So I'm trying to get a sense of what's different now. Is there anything different now with respect to earmarking law as opposed to when this murder happened? I don't think so. And I want to make sure I'm reading the memo correctly, because this no longer unlawful could be referring to other changes in the law that aren't specifically related to earmarking. It's kind of an esoteric question, but...
I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, having looked at it again, it probably should have said not unlawful, because, yeah, earmarking, I mean, accepting earmark contributions in and of itself isn't illegal. I mean, you just need to forward it and report it properly.
I misspoke. I meant to get around the limits. Right? If the donor's already maxed out to Senator X, and then you hit that same contributor up and say, hey, you can give us money, we'll give money to Senator X, because that way you get around the limits and your solicitation says that. That's you know, that's, but then the reporting issue is a whole other issue. Let me ask this. Let me ask a general question to Mr. Elias. The commission, we have recommendations, which is really the conclusion. It's not like a MERV where we're adopting a factual legal analysis, so it's not necessarily the analysis of the commission. But just for fun, do you have any concerns with the analysis, or is there any issues that you may see down the road that will not give you the relief you seek or cause issues that may... we may not anticipate here today, but you may see, because you're uniquely situated to see them because it's your client and your fundraising program.
Yeah, no, I think that the relief granted is what we're seeking. I'm glad you pointed out one of the issues that has been, I think, at the heart of this, and I don't wish to relitigate what was argued with the commission 20 years ago, which is that, you know, you can have first of all, you can legally earmark, political committees can legally earmark contributions. And therefore, it is simply not a correct statement of law to say that political committees cannot earmark. And to the extent we entered into a conciliation agreement that says we will not and cannot earmark contributions, it's a little bit like a corporation entering into a conciliation agreement in 1995 saying, you know, we won't make independent expenditures, right? Except, actually, I would argue back then we could have earmarked under, as long as it was reported properly and the like. So I think that this gives the relief that we seek. I do think there remains an enduring disagreement between perhaps me and the commission of 20 years ago. None of you were here over whether or not what was happening at that time was in fact legal or not, whether it was in fact earmarking or not. In fact, one of the things that I always found curious, again, and then I'll shut up because it sounds like I'm litigating what happened 20 years ago, is shortly after this conciliation agreement, as you know, Congress changed the law. McCain-Feingold goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, and lo and behold, what is put in the record by the proponents of defending McCain-Feingold?
Your tally system.
But the tally system. Yeah. And the Supreme Court brushes through the tally system like it is as legal as the day is long. And yet, I'm sitting with MER 3620. So it has never been my We settled the case. I think I'm probably barred from disputing the underlying facts or law. So maybe I should just be quiet there. But I think this gives the relief we want, whatever ambiguity may have existed at the time as to the lawfulness of the conduct.
Thank you, Commissioner Walther.
Thank you. The issue to me would be I'm supporting of this modification. I think that seems to me to be the most appropriate way to do it is to, if you have an agreement, let's modify it, rather than unilaterally just say, you know, it's waived. You've got nothing to go home to except, you know, that, and I think we ought to make it clear what is being modified. So it seemed to me that maybe the best thing to do is to work with the General Counsel's office and come up with a modified agreement and have us look at that that does that. I think the relief you want should be granted. But I think a modified agreement procedure is the way to do it, that you request. As I understand it, we would just modify the agreement. Portions of it still remain in full force and effect, but the following paragraph would go out, something to that effect. I don't know quite how you want to phrase it, but I'm just talking procedurally now from my perspective.
Unless you have a Madam Vice Chair? I'm not sure if you were asking Mr. Elias.
Well, I didn't get a response, so I'm not too sure how you react to that. So some other commissioner can go ahead now and give me one.
If the commission wants my views, I'm happy to provide it. Okay.
Madam Vice Chair.
All due respect to my colleague, I actually would not be comfortable with that. I appreciate the fact that Mr. Elias did not come in and, despite a little bit of trying to relitigate history there, in his formal request at least, did not try and rewrite history, go back in time, and make us unwind 20 years' worth of what happened. What happened then happened. Whether anybody here would have voted for the same thing is immaterial. I would be very uncomfortable with the commission seeking to reopen 20 years later a conciliation agreement. I think one of the and modifying it. I don't think you want to enter into another conciliation agreement, I'm guessing. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the way I read your request is that you are seeking a change in prospective conduct. You're not seeking to redo or undo something that happened in the past so much as seeking relief on a prospective basis. This is a really unusual agreement. I mean, I was trying to think, and I asked some of the lawyers who have been here longer than I have. I can't remember another agreement since I've been here, and none of our lawyers could come up with another example of an agreement that didn't just say you'll cease and desist violating the law or you'll comply with the law, but actually imposed an affirmative obligation that is not literally required by the law and regulations. I mean, there's no regulation that says that you have to put, you know, that disclaimer on your solicitations. That was solely a product of the conciliation agreement. And I'm actually not aware of any other conciliation agreements where we sort of impose this ongoing obligation from now until the end of time. And we are talking about a committee that's got a, you know, it's not going to go out of, it's not like a candidate committee that might go out of business and terminate. This is an ongoing committee. It strikes me that that may not have been a well-advised way to construct a conciliation agreement, and maybe there's a reason why we couldn't come up with another example of another one. So I think that's part of the problem, is that the way this was structured, you're under this obligation till the end of time, and it's not a simple obligation just to comply with the rules of the law. Does counsel want to correct me on this?
No, I agree entirely with what the vice chair has said. I think it's important to point out, if one looks at the recommendations, that it's not seeking to terminate the agreement non pro tonc as if it never existed. Rather, it's simply asking, we're simply recommending that that the DSCC be relieved of fulfilling its ongoing obligation, which is the obligation that the vice chair made reference to. So we're not seeking to unwind the conciliation agreement.
And my understanding from the memo is that there's no regulation or specific policy that allows us to do this, but with four votes, it's fine to do.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Thank you. Madam Vice Chair.
Well, that's another oddity about this. I'm not exactly I'm not exactly sure. I guess the commission can just declare, okay, we're done now. But I think it probably was, it's a very unusual circumstance. We couldn't come up with another example of it.
I know this is if I might, is different, but what about the conciliation agreements where we tell somebody that they can't serve as a treasurer any longer for any federal political committee? I mean, that obviously goes on for as long as the person is alive.
No. Usually those are time limited. I can't recall one that was
like
forever.
There are 10 or there are a significant amount of time.
They're time limited. There could be time years. And those were always for instances where somebody had mishandled funds. Mm-hmm. You know, we had embezzlers. We thought we were trying to protect other committees from being embezzled by someone who had clearly established they were not careful stewards of the funds that were put in their care. But we don't. I'm not aware of any other agreement that contains some requirement that a committee do something till the end of time. And I think that was probably, as I said, ill-advised. I'm not interested in, and that's why I view this almost as sui generis, that I would be very reluctant to start down the road of saying, okay, we're going to start reexamining every agreement that's that the commission has ever issued, because it just we have to have closure. But as Mr. Elias suggested, if a corporation had entered into a CA with us 10 years ago, and one of the provisions was that they were never going to do independent expenditures, because at the time we thought that was illegal, and perhaps they had done it back then, I think that a corporation who had agreed to that could certainly come back now. I'm not aware of any, but they could, if they existed, come back now and say, well, at post-CU, I don't have to. I'm not bound by that anymore, and I can't imagine
they'd even have to come back.
Yeah, I'm not. I can't imagine. Well, they had, but because they promised, if they had actually written something down and said, "Okay, I will never," you know, "I promise you, FEC, I will never do independent expenditures again," I'm pretty sure there'd be 6 votes to say, "No, that's right. You don't have to. You're not bound by that anymore. We can't bind you to that anymore." So, I think this is. That's sort of the way I look at this. But having said all that, I am very comfortable with counsel's recommendation and prepared to support it.
Commissioner Walther.
Well, Mr. Lassen, you said modify the agreement. What procedure were you thinking of at that point?
I think if you look at our letter, we didn't try to propose what the mechanism was. Instead, we tried to bring it in a friendly, constructive fashion to the attention of the General Counsel's office, and hoped that they would engage in exactly the kind of process they have, which is to think through what are the implications for the agency, what is the right way, understanding this is a relatively unique set of facts, what's best for the agency. So truth be told, you know, I had a client who was trying to achieve a practical aim. We were not trying to force the commission to go one route or another in terms of how it actually achieves that. So we're comfortable with however the commission were to achieve that, including the way recommended by the General Counsel's office.
Any other questions or comments?
Just to apologize for having to wait 2 years for a response to this letter. That's unfortunate. It concerns me that this is still sitting around in our office and that this could be happening in other cases. I don't know what we're doing about it, but certainly this needs to be. We need a better case management system so that we all are aware of what's pending at the council level, at our level.
Any other questions or comments? Is there a motion? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we approve Council's recommendation as set forth in agenda document number 12-79.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Without objection, we're going to shuffle the order of the agenda a little bit. We're going to move the reconsideration of advisory opinion 2012-25 till the end of the agenda, and also take a short recess after the audit division recommendation on Right March. Therefore, the next matter on the agenda is draft advisory opinion 2012-34, Freedom PAC and Friends of Mike H. My understanding is we have counsel with us today.
Mr. Levy, are you there? This is Sean Worth from the commission. Mr. Levy?
I am. I'm just trying to mute my computer.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. I will turn you over to Chair Hunter. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Levy. How are you today?
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. First, we'll have a presentation by the Office of General Counsel, Mr. Nevin Stepanovic. And as you know, there's two drafts on the record right now, and also a late submitted comment that we've just been handed to us right now. I don't know if somebody from the Office of General Counsel has been able to email that to you yet.
I didn't catch what you just said.
Okay, there are two drafts on the public agenda in response to your advisory opinion request. In addition, we just received a late submitted comment from Perkins Coie, Mr. Mark Elias, who was actually just with us a few minutes ago. And we haven't even had a chance to read it, but it just came in today, just now.
Needless to say, I have not seen it.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Hunter, and good morning, Commissioners. Agenda documents 1278 and 1278A respond to a request for advisory opinion filed on behalf of Freedom PAC and Friends of Mike H. Freedom PAC is an independent expenditure-only committee. Friends of Mike H. is a principal campaign committee of Mike Haridopoulos. Mike Haridopoulos was a candidate in Florida's 2012 Senate primary election, but withdrew his candidacy before the primary election. He was not a candidate in the 2012 general election, does not hold any federal office. The requesters ask two questions. First, may Freedom PAC accept a contribution of $10,000 or more from Friends of Mike H.? And second, if the answer to question one is no, may Freedom PAC accept a contribution of up to $5,000 from Friends of Mike H.? There are two drafts before you. Agenda document 1278 concludes that Freedom PAC may accept a contribution of $10,000 or more from Friends of Mike H. Agenda document 1278A, on the other hand, concludes that Freedom PAC may not accept a contribution of $10,000 or more from Friends of Mike H. because Friends of Mike H. may not make contributions in excess of $5,000 per calendar year to Freedom PAC. The Commission received one comment on the advisory opinion request and one comment on the advisory opinion drafts that was received at 10 o'clock this morning, just before the meeting. I'll be happy to address any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. And my understanding is that the deadline for this advisory opinion is December 3rd. And just so the public knows, it doesn't look like we'll be able to vote on this draft today. And as I believe we've told council, we may request an extension till December 7th in order to consider this again at our next public meeting. It's also possible that we won't have to wait until then, but we may ask you to do that, sir, at the end of this discussion. Are there any questions or comments for Mr. Levy on the drafts? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't really have any questions or comments on the drafts per se, except to say that we were hoping to get some comments on the drafts. We didn't get them out as promptly as we could have. But as you said, we're really at the we have a lot more time on the 60 days on this one. I appreciate that we got a comment this morning, and we may get others. I'm interested in reading this comment and any others that get filed, but since it was just handed to me, it would be inaccurate to say that I've studied it and had a chance to fully think it through. So I appreciate that we have a little bit more time on this, and I personally would not be prepared to vote today so that we can consider this comment. And if anybody else out there wants to comment on this, we'd be happy to hear from you.
This is Larry Levy, if I may. Obviously, I don't know what Mr. Elias has said. Hopefully, he supports Draft A. but I will look forward to reading it. The two drafts.
You're in luck, Mr. Levy.
He does support draft A. He urges the commission to reject draft B.
Well, I must say that this is not the first time I have agreed with Mr. Elias's sage reading of the law. The two drafts are very similar. They both agree that the committee can make a Mike Age can make a donation to an independent expenditure committee. The only distinction is whether the donation may be in excess of $5,000. And draft B focuses on essentially one clause or one word. 300.60D indicates that entities that are directly or indirectly established, financed, maintained, controlled by or acting on behalf of one or more federal candidates or individuals holding federal office. And at the time that Mike H. was established, it was established for a candidate in the primary seeking federal office. However, Mike H. sees to be a candidate. 300.61D, which says you must follow the limits, interestingly says no person described in 11 CFR 300.60 shall solicit, receive, direct, transfer, or spend funds. The only person referred to in 60 is a federal candidate or office holder. There is no federal candidate or office holder involved in this any longer. Once the candidate withdraws, there is no such person. Indeed, Mike H., the human being neither a candidate or office holder, could go out and solicit money for Freedom PAC or any other independent expenditure group in any amount of money because he's no longer a candidate. In addition, the commission has on many occasions, most recently in the Perry case, Advisory Opinion 2012-6, has stated that a connected committee can file a Form 1 and become a non-connected committee and make these donations, despite the fact that the very narrow reading draft B gives to the law would say this committee was initially established by a federal candidate. So the commission has the authority to interpret this and has interpreted it that once you're no longer a federal candidate, you could change the nature of the committee. Mike H. doesn't want to currently change the nature of the committee, but recognize rather these changed circumstances and not have this, not arbitrary, but not have this limitation placed on it. Similarly, Common Sense 10 allowed the committees to raise and spend unlimited funds so long as it wasn't done by a federal candidate or office holder. And then in 2011-12, when it changed to majority PAC, said, well, the office holders and candidates could appear at a function, can speak on behalf of the super PAC. They just can't ask for more than the $5,000. And that is because they are an active office holder or candidate. No other reason. So it seems to me that we are being in draft B rather silly in the way we read this regulation in such a limited way, especially recognizing the way we treat candidates and office holders being allowed to attend events, seek funding, convert the committee to a non-connected committee, et cetera. And I believe the commission can interpret it in any way it so desires and has functionally interpreted it by allowing it to change to a non-connected committee in the past without having to declare 441 unconstitutional, as draft B suggests. Indeed, as I just heard this commission tell Mr. Elias, I don't know if I got it exactly right, you have no law or regulation allowing the commission to say the DNC no longer has to abide by the 20-year-old agreement. But if four commissioners vote to allow that to happen, I guess it's okay. I think the commission has ample authority and leeway, and that this is, in fact, a cogent and rational way to read the regulation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Levy. Any other questions or comments, Madam Vice Chair?
Okay, I will ask Mr. Levy a question. And Mr. Levy, just so you know, I really haven't made up my mind on this, but I would like to give you an opportunity to respond to an argument that the committee was an entity, is an entity that was established, financed, maintained, or controlled by a candidate. It was established by a candidate. And under 441 IE, the law says that such a committee that was established by a candidate is not allowed to direct, transfer, or spend funds unless they are subject to the limits, prohibitions, and reporting requirements of the Act. Arguably, while the money, the argument would be, and I want to give you a chance to respond specifically to this argument, the argument would be that while the money came in limited chunks, it would be going out in one gigantic chunk, in a series of gigantic chunks that were at least in excess of the normal contribution limits. So why don't we have a problem under 441 IE?
As I think I indicated, the fact that there is no longer a federal candidate who is making a decision, controlling, or in any way connected to this committee.
But the committee was established by a candidate, right?
And so is Governor Perry's committee and countless other committees that have simply filed a Form 1 and said, well, now we're a non-connected committee and we can do whatever we want. And this commission has repeatedly authorized that. And I said most recently, this very commission, the six commissioners sitting today, authorized that in Governor Perry's situation. So I think it's a distinction in form over function, and it's just unduly restrictive. I also believe this is a highly unusual situation. There are very few failed candidates who are sitting on a bunch of money at the end of their candidacy to give away. At least in my experience, you're far more likely to find a campaign committee that continues to be in existence because it can't pay its debt.
All due respect, Mr. Levy, it frequently happens that people leave office with a whole pot of money left over. So it's not – I think this actually could happen again, perhaps not with a failed candidate, but with a candidate perhaps who is successful and then decides he's going to retire or resign from office. So I think maybe the ramifications are a little bit bigger than you're suggesting, but that's not – That's not
right. Commissioner, even if that does happen, if that former federal official files a Form 1 and says, I'm now a non-connected committee, despite the fact that that person may have been a candidate and federal official for eons, they no longer have any limitations.
And I think that's the crux.
Why shouldn't the rule have been applied that once established by a federal candidate, you can never change your stripes?
And I take it that's the crux of your argument, that if indeed he could reconstitute himself as a different – the committee could reconstitute itself as a multi-candidate committee and then or another kind of committee and then do the same thing, then why make it go through that extra step? We might as well just say, you know, go ahead.
Right. Under those circumstances, and I think draft A very – simply and succinctly establishes that.
Thank you.
Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple things I want to state, because since Mr. Levy's not here, he can't read body language, that I'm in favor of draft A, so at least he knows where certain folks are. Two more points. One is a question for Mr. Levy. Generally, is there any do you have any issue with anything in draft A? You haven't had a long opportunity to comment. I don't think you've filed written comments on it, but I want to give you the opportunity and it may be you have no comments and you're fine with draft A. I want to make sure we're not missing anything. And the second question goes to the discussion you just had with the vice chair. There's really has never been an issue with a campaign committee converting to a PAC, to a non-connected committee. The question I have for let's reverse it. Let's make this the first question. When that campaign committee converts to a PAC, is that actually reconstituting a new committee? Or in the eyes of the FEC, is it the same committee? Meaning, do they get a new FEC ID number, or is it the same ID number? Because if it's the same ID number, this is really just semantics, because it's not even really converting, but I don't think anyone has a problem with folks converting to a quote-unquote new committee. Anyone at the table have any thought on that, maybe on the staff director side?
Ms. Ciccone?
Yeah. The same ID number is used. So when they convert, they're just actually amending their Form 1 to change the committee type, and then the committee continues with the ID number, because they're not actually terminating. If they terminated, that would end that ID number, and then they'd have to register again to be given a new ID number. So they are maintaining the same ID.
Could I follow up on that? Mm-hmm. If this converted committee with the same ID number that was originally established by a federal candidate receives a contribution in excess of the candidate limits, meaning they get a $5,000 check, which is a PAC limit, would you send a RAD letter saying that that committee has potentially received an excessive contribution because the committee was originally established by a federal candidate and therefore subject to the candidate limits, even though it's become a PAC?
No.
No. Because once it becomes a PAC, at least with respect to how RAD, and I assume audit, I don't want to assume the head of audit's at the table for future matters on the agenda, but my assumption is at least with respect to the nitty-gritty of reports, the fact that it was originally established by someone who was a candidate at the time literally goes away once it converts to a PAC.
That's correct, because
that's correct.
It's now a new committee type.
Okay. All right. So back to Mr. Levy. Any thoughts on draft A? I support it, but I want to make sure I'm not that I don't want to fail to give you an opportunity to correct anything or help my thinking on draft A.
No, as I indicated, I thought draft A very simply and succinctly comes to the right conclusion. If I remember correctly, I think it did cite the Rick Perry decision that this commission issued earlier in the year as part of its basis. It did not go into a lengthy explanation, but I think we're all better off with fewer lengthy explanations.
Thank you. I don't believe there are any other comments or questions at this moment, but Mr. Levy, are you amenable to an extension on this advisory opinion request until December 7th?
Yes, I am, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And as I said, it's possible that we'll have a decision for you before then, but we put it till December 7th in the event that we wanted to discuss this again at the next open meeting. Madam Vice Chair.
In the absence of an immediate election coming up, there is no reason to unduly tie your hands.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Vice Chair.
I also appreciate that, Mr. Levy. I just wanted to state that since we did get one comment just before we walked in the door. And for all we know, there will be others. I want to make sure Mr. Levy knows that he's free to submit written comments on if he comes up with something else that he wants to say about draft A or draft B, if he wants to comment on the comment or on any other comments that we may or may not receive. I would be happy, we'd be all happy to read them. So that opportunity remains out there.
Yes, it does. Comment away.
Excellent. I appreciate the opportunity, but I'll try to keep my pencil down.
Okay. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Mr. Levy.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Take care. Thank you. The next matter on the agenda is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on WriteMarch.com PAC A09-25. I don't know if there's any presentation from Auditor OGC. If not, we'll move on to the motion that's on the table.
That's good.
Okay. There's a motion on the table from the last open meeting. It's spelled out in the minutes. Commissioner McGann moved to approve the part of finding 2 that concludes that WriteMarch.com PAC Incorporated demonstrated that the terms of the contract are in the normal course of the vendor's business and the appropriate supporting language in the report that supports that conclusion in finding 2. Is there any discussion on the motion? Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the attempt to find more areas that we can agree on. It's always a worthy exercise, but I'm not going to be able to support the motion. For me, it was a very close call as to whether it's a it was not a contribution, and I was willing to find that it is, you know, I think they provided some evidence, but not, not all of the evidence that we might have wanted to see about the contract and similar contracts. But, you know, what it comes down to is that I was comfortable with the conclusion about the contract when it went along with debt reporting. I find it more difficult to split it because, to me, it's interrelated. The reporting is related to the conclusion. So, regretfully, I'm not going to be able to support the motion.
Commissioner McGann.
The committee, and not only the committee, but others who participate in politics and raise money and do the sorts of things that this audited committee does, are potentially left now twisting in the wind, because there's two there's two unanswered questions here. Well, there's really three. First, there was already a motion to adopt the finding, and you don't get to that part of the you don't get to that conclusion until you agree the contract is okay. So there's already been a vote where three commissioners have, whether they knew it or not at the time, voted to say the contract was fine. And the purpose of my motion was merely to make clear that there's actually six commissioners that think the contract is fine. Now we learn that there were three, and now there's still three, but it's a different three, only at the FEC. Does that rhyme? Sort of. What other proof would they have to offer to satisfy the concern? The statement was made that there's more they could have done or whatnot. They hired an outside counsel. They had very thorough treatment. We discussed at length the number of other contracts they provided. What else would they have had to show you to make this contract okay? And two, I don't follow how this is intertwined. Either the contract is okay or it isn't. Contract's okay so long as we get them on the debt, but if we don't get them on the debt, then we have to get them on the contract. I hope that's not what we're saying. But for those who have to do this sort of thing in the future, what they take away from this is really the general question that ties together the two issues that I've heard raised here at the table. If anyone wants to try to answer, that's fine. I guess you don't have to, but not answering sends a message that if you want to try to comply, well, too bad. We'll keep you in the air.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we don't have any examples of agreements with the vendor's other customers. But, I mean, for me, it really is more the second point than the first. And I fully understand that for you these are two separate, segregable issues, and they're just not for me. But, you know, I think we're just going to disagree on that.
Commissioner McGann?
So going forward, if they would, let me get this straight. If they would decide to report it as debt, then the contract is okay? Or is it, but because they don't report debt, then the contract's not okay? Is that what the takeaway is?
I mean, I think under our analysis, we would look at them. It wouldn't be dispositive to one or the other. If they reported the debt, as we took the position that they should have reported the debt, that wouldn't necessarily go to whether or not it was an impermissible, it resulted in an impermissible in-kind contribution or not.
So even the auditor's own report doesn't conflate them. They're not intertwined, right? Could you say that in the mic? I see you're nodding no, but just for fun for those listening at home.
Yes, we don't believe they're intertwined, other than the fact that they're based on similar, the same set of documentation and facts. We see them as two separate issues.
Madam Vice Chair.
Well, the original report had them both in one finding, and then this was an attempt to segregate out those two issues. So, you know, I found it more persuasive when it was all part of the same finding.
Commissioner McGann?
In that one finding, since we just now, we're finding common ground, I think now we agree it was all in one finding. We had this discussion last time, but just to refresh everyone's memory, part of that finding was that the contract was, and I'm using sort of shorthand, the contract was okay, meaning there was no in-kind. Right? That's part of what the auditors determine, which is part of the finding. You don't get to the debt issue without deciding the predicate contract issue. So to say it's all part of it was all in one finding, when you vote for that finding, you've already bought into what I'm saying on the contract and what you're saying on the contract, right?
Let me start off by saying we probably could have made a better presentation of this in the report, and I'll take that as a learning experience for the future. But again, the issues are separate. Based on the documentation and information they provided to us, we determined that the contract appeared to be didn't extend credit in the normal course of business. However, we still feel the debt needs to be reported.
Mr. Calvert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I can just clarify a bit OGC's thinking on this. Our advice to the auditors at the interim stage was there's an issue here as to whether there are two issues here. There's an issue here as to whether this no-risk fundraising contract represented an impermissible corporate contribution and whether it did or didn't. The Commission has always, to our knowledge, always treated no-risk arrangements as extensions of credit, which are subject to the rules on the reporting of debt. The committee came back with information regarding, it came back with an affidavit regarding its own practices. It came back with 32 contracts provided by other vendors that indicated to us that the practice was not unusual in the fundraising industry. We also looked at whether, in fact, the activity paid for itself, because that had come up. That had been one of the particular factors that had been looked at in prior no-risk matters. And the representation of the vendor was that, yes, that the activity paid for itself. So we recommended a conclusion that there was no impermissible contribution here. That does not change our recommendation that I understand others may not agree with it, but our recommendation separately is these types of arrangements have always been treated as extensions of credit and extensions of credit or debt subject to reporting. Now, we didn't get to this point because we thought there was no contribution here. But if you were, I can see an argument that if you were to say that the basis for there was no need to report because the committee never really owed anything here because it was never going to owe anything and there wasn't a debt, then I can see an argument that that reopens the question as to whether there was an impermissible contribution.
Okay, you see that. I don't. Could you explain that?
Because you're getting awfully close to concluding that the committee is getting something for nothing.
If it pays for itself and there's no debt, how can they still get something for nothing?
If the committee in the previous AOs and MERS on these types of arrangements, one of the things that the Commission has looked at is all of the risk of loss in an arrangement where there is some risk of loss borne by the vendor as opposed to the committee. The committee has, if the committee doesn't give up some sort of consideration equal to the usual and normal charge and the fair market value for this type of transaction, it's getting the services of the fundraising vendor plus, in this particular instance, 5% off the top, arguably without having provided equivalent consideration. Now, I'm not saying that we'd go there. We didn't reach that. We didn't have to reach that because we concluded that this met the standards that had been set forth in the New York advisory opinion from 91 and the CLPAC MER. But it does, if you conclude that the reason they didn't have to pay to report a debt was they never owed anything in the first place because they were never obligated to provide anything in the first place, then you at least get close to raising that issue. We said, no, that this turned out to meet all, to check all the boxes, and it wasn't an in-kind contribution, but we've always treated these as extensions of credit, and so you still got to report them as extensions of credit.
My question, though, was that was a nice explanation. It wasn't responsive to what the question was, though, because my question had the predicate assumption that if it's not an in-kind, and if there's, or if it pays for itself, and if there's not debt, how does an in-kind result? And you sort of stripped away those predicate assumptions and then answered a different question, I think. Let me try to rephrase the question this way. If this contract resulted in an in-kind contribution, that cannot also result in reportable debt. I mean, if it prohibited in-kind, this doesn't trigger debt reporting. It's a prohibited in-kind.
A prohibited in-kind can trigger debt reporting if the way it becomes a prohibited in-kind is that if an extension of credit that is permissible ab initio ripens into to a contribution over time through a failure to collect.
Sure, but we're not talking about that. I'm not talking hypotheticals. I'm talking about this case, and you understand what – I think you understand what I'm asking, and now we're tapping around a little bit here. Situation where this contract, these facts, results in a prohibited in-kind, which is different than what I think your conclusion is legally and what the auditors agreed with and what they think, right? But let's assume that predicate is different. So you have a prohibited in-kind. That prohibited in-kind, is that also reportable as debt? No. It's a prohibited in-kind. It's not a reportable debt. The Commission's never taken that position before.
I think that's right if it was void ab initio. In these types of arrangements, where some of them we've seen before that that have worked or that we didn't reach a final conclusion on. What we've seen is that the committee reports the money that comes in as part of the fundraising scheme. It reports those as contributions in, even if it doesn't actually touch it, and the vendor keeps it. But then it reports, you know, we said that an important part of the of whether it's a contribution or not really doesn't get found out at the beginning. It gets found out whether if it pays for itself over time. A lot of prospecting schemes don't. What committees have done is reported the debt.
Can I ask you something? What's your basis for that statement you just made, that a lot of prospecting schemes don't pay for themselves?
In the previous matter, in some of the previous matters we've seen, I mean, that's the reason for the no-risk aspect to the contract.
It's a broad statement. I mean, a couple of MERS or a couple of previous matters, that's a broad statement that regarding prospecting, right? I mean, I want to get a sense of how broad was that assertion.
In the ones that we have seen, there has been some risk that the prospecting did not pay for itself, a considerable risk, and as described in AO 1991-18, a prospecting scheme is considerably more speculative than a solicitation of proven donors.
Does the AO use the word scheme?
I'm sorry. I don't mean to be pejorative by using the word scheme.
That's my point. You are. You're starting with a presumption that there's something suspect about these. When you say a broad statement that a lot of these have, and I don't, you know, the statement I just questioned you on, and scheme and that sort of thing. And my point is, you have a committee here that probably looked at what happened before. I assume they did. They have a little bit of a new wrinkle as to the debt issue, and I'm buying it. We've already established that, right? I'm still hung up on the interrelation between the two issues, and I haven't heard anything that makes any sense that to get to that somehow if there was a prohibited in-kind, meaning the first issue, the contract issue, goes the other way, that we need to worry about the debt reporting.
I think it goes back, actually, it does go back to my earlier answer about whether the contribution is because the extension is void ab initio or whether it ripens over time. One of the important factors that the Commission has looked at in these, and actually the one that pushed us over the edge in this one to no, there's no contribution here, is that the activity paid for itself. It didn't initially pay for itself. It raised enough money to pay for itself over time. That difference between paying for itself and not yet paying for itself is what the Commission has traditionally viewed as an extension of credit, and if it's an extension of credit, in our view, it was reportable.
Let me ask this final question. Let's assume this committee or a similarly situated committee enters into the same deal or a materially indistinguishable deal, meaning they use the same contract. Difference is that committee reports some debt. Mm-hmm. What's the answer? What's the legal answer to that? Is that a clean bill of health, or are there still loose ends?
Materially indistinguishable, except that assuming the debt's fully reported.
Right.
I think that's a clean bill of health.
Okay. Commissioner Walther, did you still have a comment? Sorry to.
No, I was just wondering if, you know, I don't think votes are going to change based on that conversation. You had a question. Last time you said there should be a memo entry at some point. This is contingent liability. Am I missing that? If there was a memo entry that could be made when you do file it. Sorry about that. I'm ready to vote.
Mr. Hittermister, do you have a response to that?
I think there was discussion about the reporting of estimated debts related to this, but I don't think there was a memo entry involved, or maybe a memo notation.
Right. I don't want to steal it. Some debt was reported, Commissioner Peterson. We were talking, sorry.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to clarify with the auditors and counsel is that this isn't a circumstance where the audited committee claims that it had no debt to report. They did report some debt.
That's correct.
Footnote 3 talks about that the RMC reported debt of a little over $279,000.
That's correct.
This was a question not of whether or not they reported debt or didn't report debt. It was what was the amount of that debt. As I understand it, the audited committee, their concern was that there were statements that were being given to them that they claim were that the auditors categorized as invoices, and they dispute that they really were invoices. They, as they put it, they said, according to the RMC, the amounts listed on financial statements totaling over $1.6 million represented the maximum possible amounts that PA could earn if the telemarketing campaign were exceptionally successful. To me, that seemed like that was where the core of the dispute was, as they were saying those statements really aren't invoices in that these were as I said, there were statements about what might come in if we were doing very well, but it's not necessarily the amount. And they claimed that really what the actual amount was that they owed was and ended up paying was about $568,000, right?
That's correct.
And this wasn't the case where they said we were getting an extension of credit that we never had to pay, that we never had to report, because they actually did report nearly $280,000 in debt.
Correct.
Okay.
Madam Chair. If I could clarify perhaps with our colleagues from the audit division, our understanding was that they had represented that No, they because this wasn't these weren't really invoices. Nothing had to be reported, period. And we weren't entirely sure why they had reported, given that argument, why they had reported the $279,000 or what that represented.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we never got a clear answer on why they were reporting some of the debt and not all of it.
Okay.
The closest we got is that that represented some basic costs that the committee was required to pay for.
And
paper
we,
printing, that kind of thing.
Okay. And, of the, and well, and I guess another explanation could be of that 568 that there could have been some of that could have been paid within the.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, no problem. Was there a further clarification?
I've just been reminded that they eventually dropped reporting that debt. I forget which year it was.
They dropped reporting it?
The debt that they had been reporting.
Okay. Do we know for what reason?
No.
Is it because it was no longer that it was no longer on their books, or was it that they determined that they should have never reported in the first place, or is it that that's just not?
I would be speculating if I answered. Okay. I don't know why they dropped it. They just dropped from subsequent reports to the audited period.
Okay. But in terms of any discrepancy between the 279 and 568, we don't really. I mean, it could be that they actually paid those amounts off before they went on to another report, so they wouldn't necessarily, they could have been paid off in a timely manner so that no debt was ever incurred, but we just don't know the actual facts as to why there's a discrepancy between those two numbers.
The 568 would have included some invoices they paid that did not represent debt.
Okay. Thanks.
Commissioner McGann.
Just one point on that. It's not that we don't know. If there's a debt on the report and the debt disappears, I think it's safe to say that means it's paid off. It's not nearly the mystery. I mean, I don't want to suggest or leave the auditors thinking that they somehow didn't ask questions they were supposed to ask. When a report's filed under oath, I think we take it at face value, right? And it just because they don't know sitting here today doesn't mean the report doesn't speak for itself. And if you want to say, well, they were hiding the ball and it was a wrong report, that's an entirely different issue. But that's not, it's not an open vacuum. And I don't think you're suggesting that.
Yeah, and to the extent I was, that came across, that's not at all what I was suggesting. I was suggesting that there could be a perfectly straightforward and innocent way to explain why their reports said what they said and that the representations they made are consistent with their overall argument.
Commissioner Bowerly?
I just want to back up to the debt reporting issue because, and then this is the question for Ms. Ciccone. I mean, if a debt is no longer showing up, we would expect to see that it has been on another part of the report paid off. It would never just drop off. I have no idea why it changed or what they did, but I assume the auditors would have been able to tell whether it had been paid off by the same report that did not show the debt would have showed a payment if that's what they had done.
That's right. They're required to disclose the debt until fully extinguished, so we would expect to see payments on disbursement schedules and then to show that the debt was paid off on the Schedule D as well. And if it was just dropped, it would be something that in the course of a review we would question.
As well in the context of an audit, if we saw something drop off, we would ask questions as well.
Commissioner McGann?
In this case, there's no question that the committee was paying in some form to the fundraising consultant, whether it was via a prospecting deal, so that was a take the money that comes in and pay the bill, or a direct payment. I mean, it's not as if there was no money. It's not like the committee just didn't pay for anything, right? So you can't necessarily connect the debt falling off with what money was moving that may have extinguished the debt. But again, it's not that they've done anything wrong. It just maybe not be as clear as some would like, or we really haven't focused on that issue. So we're at this point completely making it up on why the debt fell off the books.
If we saw the debt drop off the report and if we saw a payment on Schedule B and we couldn't associate it and the committee did not report it on a Schedule D as a payment extinguishing the debt, especially if the amounts differ or don't add up exactly. I don't know that we could initially presume that that payment was for the debt since they were paying the vendor for other services simultaneously.
Okay. There's no other comment. There's a motion on the table. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion fails 3-3. I believe that's all we have for this audit for today. Mr. Hintermister, do you have everything you need for now? You'll go back and...
Yeah, we're fine. We're good.
Okay. Mr. Bonovitz?
Are we okay on finding three, the last... going through the last votes, we voted to approve all three findings... And that didn't go, and then you did finding one and two. Do we need to do three?
Madam Vice Chair?
I think it could be a little confusing. There was a motion to approve one and three that
early.
Failed.
Right.
And then there was a motion to approve one, and that actually passed.
Right.
So I suppose one could infer from that three failed. If people think it would add clarity, I suppose we could move three separately.
Well, that's what I meant. I wanted to get clarification so I understood and was certain.
Communications again.
Failed 3-3.
But then there was a motion to approve 1, 2, and...
I think everybody agrees that three failed.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much. Sorry.
Thank you. We're going to take a recess at this time and reconvene at noon in order to discuss the AFF matter and the Maine Republican Party audit. Thank you. Hello, the open meeting is back in session, and we will now consider a request for reconsideration of Advisory Opinion 2012-25. A little bit of background regarding this advisory opinion request. The Commission considered this request at the October 4th open meeting. And we told the requester that we were working on a compromise draft and we hoped to get one to him. We said alternatively, if we're not able to do a compromise draft, then what we could probably issue is some kind of what we call here a stripped down version of an advisory opinion answer. So it would say yes, but for different reasons or something along those lines, or just yes. As it turned out, after the open meeting, we were not able to come up with the compromise draft that we told requester we were trying to do. And similarly, we were not able to come up with the, quote, stripped down version. One of the reasons that I want to put this back on the agenda is because I think we left him with the impression that one or the other was going to happen. And so understandably, he got the letter on October 12th saying that the FEC was not able to issue an advisory opinion request, and he was probably confused. So then the requester sent in a letter on October 15th requesting reconsideration of the matter by the commission, stating in essence that he would like the protection of an advisory opinion, which of course needs four votes, and he said it would be better to have something that stated that the commission wasn't able to agree on a single rationale. And he was okay with not having four or six votes for a single rationale. So following that letter, there were other conversations amongst commissioners, and we've been working with Commissioner Walther, and thank you for your time and effort to try to come up with something, Commissioner Walther. He put a draft blue last night, which I think we're calling draft C, and we were hoping that the requester might be able to... The document is 12-69-C. That's the one that was made blue last night. I'm not sure what letter we're calling it, but we'll call it C just because that's what's at the top of the agenda document, 12-69-C.
There was a previous one.
Yeah, that's a trouble.
All right, we'll just call it 12-69-C. How's that? So that one went on the website last night. And Mr. Trochinski was not able to join us today, so we don't have the benefit of any comments from him on this draft. Apparently, he wasn't able to attend the open meeting today. So, I think that another thing that we'd like to do is submit yet one more draft on this subject that incorporates some comments that some had on the draft 12-69C, with the hopes that we'll hear from the requester on whether that version, which he hasn't seen yet, but hopefully we'll see in the near future, whether that is more amenable to him than not having an advisory opinion at all. So hopefully we'll hear from him and perhaps take this up again in the future. Are there any questions or comments on the issue? Commissioner Walther?
Just a comment in the sense that maybe twofold. One, I didn't really consider it, even though it's entitled this agenda item, a motion for reconsideration, that exactly being one, because to my knowledge, there's no movement in connection with the drafts we've already voted on. And unless the... those that voted for E want to consider modifying their position on that, I don't sense, and certainly on my own, that we would want to move to modify our position on D. And if he thinks from the conversation that we want to have a yes, that he's expecting a yes answer with different rationales, that's not what I see in the draft that I just went blue with. It is really a qualified yes, not a yes with different rationales. And so that should be made clear, and I didn't intend in that text at all to water down our position with respect to draft D. So I thought that maybe in view of his request, he wanted to give his client a little more security by being able to read one document than trying to make something out of two or maybe others, that this might be helpful, and since it seemed to be something you thought you'd like to try and take a stab at, my assistant, Rad Deutsch, began to prepare a draft, and that's basically what you're beginning to see here. So it wasn't clear to me what Mr. Trochinski was looking at, so I think we do need to get some feedback from him, and if you have another draft, that's fine with me. But I think... it should be made clear that it wasn't an attempt to try and merge our thinking with respect to our respective positions, but rather just provide a single document that gives a little more clarity for somebody who wants to read where we've been on this.
Thank you. And as I said, I appreciate your efforts, and I think this document or some version of it does just that. It explains to the public sort of more carefully where the commissioners are without either side having to compromise their position. It's, in my view, far easier for the public to follow that kind of document than to have to go back and read separate drafts. And as we know from previous experience, sometimes those separate drafts get lost in the shuffle and people forget that commissioners had different views. So I think this does a nice job if we're able to come up with something close to this with respect to the public record. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to... this may not be the appropriate time to get totally into the weeds on this, on what did happen and may be happening. I'm not sure what... It's procedurally a little bit odd. But I did want to note, because the draft that Commissioner Walther circulated, I appreciate his efforts, but it does refer to, excuse me, the views of three commissioners, and I think I'm supposed to be one of those commissioners, and I was not prepared to support this draft, so I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the wording. I'm happy to look at draft Q, or whatever the next draft will be, but I still may have procedural issues with whether there's anything actually before us at this point to answer. I mean, certainly Mr. Churchinsky could submit a new advisory opinion request that, you know, and then we'd sort of be back in at the beginning again. And I don't think we would necessarily need 60 days for that, since we've been thinking about these issues. But as I understand it right now, he's made a request, and the request, you know, the commission couldn't, sadly, we thought we could, but we couldn't come to an answer on that and told him so. So I think that request is actually concluded. So I'm not sure what this is in response to, you know, unless Mr. Churchinsky wants to submit a new request, which, of course, he's welcome to do at any time.
I think, you know, certainly he could submit another request. But as you know, this also has some unusual background on this request, because he originally submitted a very long time ago, and then there was some dispute about whether or not he needed to add a federal candidate. So he's already been kind of dealing with the FEC now for months and months. I can't remember the exact timing. But for that reason, that was another reason that I just didn't want to direct him to send another advisory opinion request, because of the background of this, and because in theory we could take an additional 60 days and then come back and say we're at the very same spot. And I didn't think that was really appropriate or fair, especially under these circumstances. With respect to the procedural issue, you know, as we discussed just a few hours ago in the Democrat Senatorial Campaign Committee request for modification of a conciliation agreement, if there are four votes, my opinion is that if there are four votes to issue a new advisory opinion, then that's something that is appropriate to do. Any other questions or comments? Commissioner Bowerly?
We're obviously not going to resolve this today, but I suppose we can always say if there are four commissioners to do something, you can do something. But as, you know, I think as Mr. Elias pointed out, and as the counsel's office noted, in this instance, in the instance of what happened in the DSCC, we don't have any, I don't know if the commission ever thought it would need a regulation to say, what do you do when a CA sort of is no longer relevant or the law changes, so we don't have anything in place. We actually do have some fairly specific regulations on advisory opinions, including ones that says we can't just issue them on our own, that they have to be in response to the provisions about how you request it and the timing and all of that. So I think in this area, I would caution us when we do have specific regulations. It's a different thing to say when we are faced with a very unique situation or something that the regulations or the law doesn't address and we don't have a policy on it. I would hope we would be nimble enough to figure out a way to get to a solution. But here, I think it's not quite the same situation to say, you know, four votes can do anything. I mean, that's sort of generally true about everything in this building, but it's not, you know, I think that's an overgeneralization. So I think, you know, we'll have to see where this goes, and obviously we're not going to decide it today, but I'm not sure what we would be deciding, because I think a motion for reconsideration would be out of order under the regulations, and, you know, if, you know, again, I agree with the vice chair, however, though, that if the requester wanted to resubmit, you know, of course we're happy to hear anything he might have to say, so.
Mr. Walther?
I understand this is breaking a little bit new ground, as I understand it, and the Office of General Counsel has given an opinion that a motion for reconsideration would be out of order. Am I correct on that?
Yes,
said that, based on what I tell you, as I see it, it's not a motion to reconsider the merits, but it's akin to some way to clarify the record on where we've been, or something along that line. Now, we could go the route of asking him to issue a new request, but it really wouldn't be for any advisory opinion as I see it, because he already knows, he's been through the drill on that, and this is really an effort to try and provide a service to a client or maybe others, you know, who might want to read about this issue. They'll know specifically without having to go to the record and see the certificate of who voted for what and try and find out, well, is that really valid? Did they really, what did D mean to E? And, you know, where are we? I don't think it would be very easy, except for some election law expert, to really understand where we were. It seemed to me that this procedure might be a service to those that want to find out, you know, what we did, if anybody ever really wants to know that, by providing this kind of a document. So if we want to do that without trying to break new rules, do you have a suggestion, or maybe ask you before we convene again to think about a procedure? I mean, certainly we can issue guidance on where we are aside from this procedure. That's one thing. We could ask him if he could waive the statute nunc pro tunc and consider this to be still in effect, I suppose, or your letter would be withdrawn based upon something further. If the letter that you send is what really closes it out, whether or not there could be some procedure to withdraw that to allow a clarification document to be filed, or whatever we want to call this. I'm just raising some thoughts with you on how to then consider how to get it done without trying to as Commissioner Bowerly says, just do four votes and just do it.
I think, Commissioner, there are procedural mechanisms that would permit the route that you have in mind going down. I don't think a motion for reconsideration is such a route, but I do think that there are other routes, and I think the two most viable paths are the ones that you mentioned. One would be, as the vice chair says, to have Mr. Torchinsky request a new opinion. He certainly is free to do that. The commission is free to issue guidance if it chooses to do so, which is another possible pathway that would get to that result. And I'm happy to think about it some more as well.
I mean, as I alluded to earlier, well, first, I suppose the cleanest way of doing it is for him to submit another request, and maybe he does so after he sees the new draft. If that's something along the lines of what he's looking for, then that would probably be the cleanest and easiest way of dealing with this. But I think, Commissioner Bowerly, I think you said something along the lines of we can't just on our own come up with a motion to reconsider. My reading of the reg at issue here, 112-6, doesn't say anything about what we would do in a circumstance not covered by the specific reading of the reg. The reg says that the commission may reconsider an advisory opinion previously issued if the person to whom the opinion was issued submits a written request for reconsideration within 30 calendar days of receipt of the opinion, and if, upon the motion of a commissioner who voted with the majority that originally approved the opinion, the commission adopts the motion to reconsider by the affirmative vote of four members. So we're not dealing with this situation because we did not issue an advisory opinion to him. So to me, if we're able to change our mind on something that had four votes at one point, then surely we can change our mind on something that only had three votes. This to me is, you know, sort of less. What we're doing here is sort of less than what this reg calls for. And nothing in the reg says that this is the only way of doing it. And there are many circumstances where there's not a specific, my view is if there's not a reg on the book, then it means you can do whatever you want. If there's a reg prohibiting it, then that's different. And this reg does not prohibit what we're talking about today. Commissioner Bowerly.
As we continue to think about this, I would point you to 112.14F that says no opinion of an advisory nature may be issued by the commission or any of its employees except in accordance with 11 CFR 112, which are the rules about when you submit a request and when you how much time the commission has to consider and the timing for comment and all of those. So I think this actually says we can't do this, but that's my reading of the reg, and I think you got to fit them together. And this one, yes, we have something specific when there's been an opinion issued, but we have another one that says we can issue it outside of those specific regulations.
Madam Vice Chair.
Just a little bit on why we couldn't get to the strip down. Yes, there, and you know, maybe there's something in the works that will that four commissioners or more will agree on in the future. I'm not sure because I haven't been in those conversations. But I think that there was a misperception, perhaps, that the problem was that we all thought the answer was yes, but for different reasons. And I think that that's not quite what was going on. Three commissioners, I believe, but certainly me, let me just speak for me, I thought the answer was yes, but only under certain circumstances. And if not under those circumstances, then the answer would be no. That's not yes for a different reason. That's yes under different circumstances and under more limited circumstances. So that's why it was difficult to say I was unwilling to say yes, to sign on something that just said yes, because that would be an open-ended yes under all circumstances. And I didn't think the answer was yes under all circumstances. And that's you know, in the past, the commission has had various ways of dealing with, you know, this sort of thing has come up before. Sometimes the commissioners who are in favor of the broader view will agree to a narrower answer and then write separately and say, well, of course we thought the narrower view was okay because we think the broader view is okay, then this is just a subset. But that didn't work, and I understand why. And another way that some requesters have helped the commission to get over the hump when people were kind of starting out in different places was sometimes requesters craft their request to kind of make it easier for us and say, okay, we understand certain commissioners have issues. We will try and address those issues. Whether we are, you know, whether we concede that we are required to address those issues is not the point, but rather we're just trying to make it easy for commissioners to agree that under these circumstances the answer could be yes. So I mention that only to put it out there in case Mr. Torchinsky and Mr. Bays, not suggesting that they should or would, but in case they read the more limited answer and said, well, I could live with that if they wanted to ask that question. That obviously would be an easier one to get agreement on because under those circumstances, I think everyone would agree. But that's obviously entirely up to the requester. They get to frame their requests any way they want to.
Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to briefly address the issue about the procedural posture that we find ourselves in. As I read 112.6, before I even go into that, I mean, ultimately the commission, we issue these rules. This is many of these procedural steps, there are procedural steps in the statute. The reconsideration procedure is not in the statute. That is something that the commission has developed on its own. We get to, you know, basically interpret our own rules, and there's a boatload of case law giving great deference to a commission's ability to interpret its own rules. And to my mind, I see no problem with interpreting 112.6 to reach not only advisory opinions issued, but addressing it situations where an advisory opinion request has been resolved through the issuance of a letter saying, you know, we didn't have four votes to issue one. And I would just also point out that there's just today we granted an extension of a 60-day time limit to Mr. Levy. We asked him to extend the 60-day limit. There's nothing in our rules that say we can do that. Yet we've done that as a matter of course because we get to interpret our own rules. There's also nothing in here that says that the 60-day count. It says within 60 calendar days after receiving an advisory opinion request, the commission shall issue the requesting person an opinion. It says once we've received the request, it doesn't say when OGC determines the request is complete. So there's a lot of room in the joints here for the commission to interpret its own rules in a way that makes sense, and I think that that's what is going on here in terms of trying to deal with a situation where there was a resolution of a request that resulted in a 3-3 result.
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair.
It's an interesting analogy to the 60 days, which you're right, we routinely write. That actually is in the statute, the 60-day limit. That's not a product of our regs. It says that in the statute. But I think practically speaking, requesters, you know, if the commission says gee, we think we can give you an answer if you give us a little bit more time. Requesters generally are willing to do that in the interest of getting an answer. And who's going to sue? Who's going to complain? I don't know who would even have standing to come in and say, oh, you didn't, that advisory opinion is not valid because it's, it was issued more than 60 days. I suppose somebody could complain about conduct by that person or a person in the exact same situation who relied on the advisory opinion, which they then say was improperly issued, but what are the odds that the commission would actually take that one seriously? I think we'd probably dismiss
that. That's covered in the regulation.
So I think that's, you know, that's an interesting analogy. I hear you. I'll think about that. But I do think that it's in part a product of, you know, who's gonna complain if we do it. But it's an interesting question. What's our authority for even asking?
Mr. McGann.
Couple thoughts. First, there's actually a case on point. I think it's out of the Second Circuit regarding who has standing to sue if an AO is not done procedurally correct. It's one of the few times where someone had standing to knock out an AO. Case name eludes me, but it's a weird case in that they weren't really challenging the merits of the AO. The AO wasn't out enough for comment, I think it was, and they were able to basically knock out the AO. They weren't the requester. So it actually has happened. If I'm thinking of the case right, I think it's happened. That's who would complain. When you have something in the Act that says 60 days and the commission decides it means you can work it out with the requester, if, for example, the commission would use an AO as a sword against someone and say it articulates the rule and say, well, this AO binds us and it wasn't issued within 60 days, I could see somebody saying, nice try, the Act said 60 days, you put it within 60 days, the AO doesn't count, I guess. Turning to the matter at hand, what's frustrating for me, and I've said this before, is that AOs are supposed to be deliberated in open meetings. And we've had deliberation on this AO. We had votes, and it went 3-3. And I was certainly left with the impression that, notwithstanding 3-3, there was agreement and that there would be something done on tally vote that would be would capture the common ground. I'm not saying that's what was literally said. I'm saying that's my impression. So I don't want to have this interpreted to mean I'm saying anybody pulled a fast one. But I'm saying that's certainly how what I thought happened. And then once the meeting adjourns, and then we do this tally vote stuff, and I remember the tally votes coming around. But at that point, there's really no deliberation. So now we're sitting here, we're saying, well, the reg doesn't really let you consider this motion to reconsider because it's not really reconsidering an AO because there's really no AO. That's kind of cute, but at the end of the day, I think the way to fix this problem is in the future we have this discussion at the table, in the meeting, and make sure everyone understands what's happening in the future, because that's, as you open this discussion, that's the problem, is that we think the requester was led to think one thing. I thought that's what we were doing, and then lo and behold, there wasn't that final draft where I guess there was enough agreement, and we didn't really have a chance to deliberate that. And now it's already closed. We can't reconsider anything. The transmittal letter that goes out, I don't think the commission approves that, right? I mean, it's left at the table, and then OGC, I assume, sends a letter that says we couldn't reach an agreement. But that's not approved by the commission. What happens sometimes is the commission may instruct counsel to do a letter that does this or that. But in this case, it didn't happen because this was kind of left for another day to be done, not at an open meeting, but on tally vote, and then that just didn't quite work out to the satisfaction of a lot of us. So going forward, I've said this before and I'll say it again, we should do this in an open meeting, and it avoids this sort of situation where now we're in a situation where even though the requester says, gee, did you really mean to do this, we're being told by some we can't even really discuss it because, well, the matter's closed because, well, there's not an AO, so therefore he can't reconsider the AO. That really doesn't help decide what the reg means or what the reg doesn't mean, but I at least want to put on the record that we're in a weird situation, not because the reg doesn't squarely fit. It was caused by how the last meeting was left because I think, and it's not just me, I think many of us came away thinking that this was going to work itself out, unfortunately, behind closed doors. And once the doors close, there's no way to really know what happened or didn't happen, which is why this stuff should be done in an open meeting.
Commissioner Bowerly, when you cited the reg that you wanted us to consider, did you say 112.1F?
112.6F? 112.4F.
I'll take another look at it, but I'm not sure. Okay. Any other questions or comments on this? So if I'm the requester, I'm pretty confused, but we'll see how this transpires. We'll put hopefully yet another draft on the public record in the very near future, and we'll hear hopefully comments from the requester. Anything else? All righty. We will then move on to our last item on the agenda for today, which is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the Maine Republican Party, MRP A09-09. Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. I had objected because I wanted the chance to read the report because it's quite long. Whenever you audit the state party and you raise FEA, it's never, FEA, I mean federal election activity, it never is easy to sort through it. So I've taken a look at it. I've gone through it. I've asked the audit staff here and there for clarification on things. In a break from my usual, I actually don't have any further questions. And unless I'm missing something and other colleagues have spotted an issue, I can support the audit report. So the objection was really just to make sure I could.
Is there a motion, Madam Vice Chair?
Well, sadly, I have issues with the audit report, so.
You do?
Yes.
Oh.
You didn't know?
No.
How did you not know? You really ought to talk to your staff. But my concern is that there are, that at least parts of recommendation finding, the recommendation with respect to finding 3A, are inconsistent with the recommendation that was made in the Kansas Republican Party audit and are not, I understand that recommendation split, but I was comfortable with that recommendation then. I'm still comfortable with that recommendation. You know, and it has to do with the basic issue of what do we do when the auditors look for records to document what's federal and what's non-federal, and the records aren't there. And, you know, commissioners have different views on what the consequences ought to be of having no records, but or not having all of the records. That would make it easier for the auditors to conclusively determine what's federal and what's non-federal. But I think the problem is when there are no records, it leaves us in a quandary, because if we say, well, if there are no records, we can't make any findings, then that creates a perverse incentive to committees to throw out all their records because then they don't get any findings. So, you know, there might be some record-keeping finding, I suppose, in that case. But I do think this is a difficult issue and one that the commission has disagreed with each other in the past. I'll just verify my own understanding, counsel. Do you agree that this recommendation is inconsistent with the recommendation that was made in the Kansas Republican case last year? Audit last year, not a case.
Commissioner, essentially, yes. I think when the audit division, in fairness to them, when they made some changes to the ADRM that is before you, and I don't think they changed, I don't think either of us noticed that they had changed, had failed to change the boilerplate sentence that says OGC concurs with this. The one, I guess the best thing for me to do is just sort of go down the 4 points regarding the non-federal payments from non-federal accounts at page two of the ADRM and just compare with Kansas. There are $48,520 in administrative costs. There were some administrative costs in the Kansas Republican audit that the commission agreed should have been reported. I don't think any of those particular types, and the audit division can correct me on this if I'm wrong, I don't believe any of the types on which the commission agreed they should be reported are at issue here. I think these are the types of administrative apparent administrative costs on which the commission split in Kansas. Payroll and associated costs, that's actually, I don't think that was at issue in Kansas, but it was at issue in the Georgia audit and was the subject of a 3-3 split there. The voter identification, the committee has amended its reports to reflect that. And the printed materials that were not available for review, that also is a subject that was that's really pretty indistinguishable from Kansas.
So I think where that leaves me is I'm going to have to break up the motion because there's parts of this that I agree with and parts of it that I don't. I do agree with and I think it's all in 3A and finding 3A. I do agree with finding 3A with respect to the voter identification, the $19,000 voter identification, because I think they did come up with some documentation on that. So what I'd like to, you know, I'll just go straight to the motion so as not to belabor this unless people want to belabor it. Maybe people want to go to lunch.
They can always comment on your motions.
Yes. Okay. So my first motion will be that we approve the recommendations in the ADRM agenda document 12-75 with respect to findings 1, 2, 3B, 4, and the sub finding related to voter identification, the $19,000 for voter identification in 3A.
Are there any questions on the motion or comments? Commissioner Walther?
Does staff have any comment on this?
Not at this time, no.
All right, so how do you view, I mean, you support this?
I do. It gives us guidance, hopefully, on how to proceed. That's always been a difficult area for us when we're auditing party committees, when we look at non-federal records, on how to approach not having the records, whether, you know, some cases we can pursue it. We used to pursue it as a funding issue. And so any direction we can get in that area would be appreciated.
Okay, so the motion that I see breaks this out. I wasn't aware, by the way, either. I'm sorry not to be more prepared on it, but I guess one of the things that would be important to me is to know, do you disagree with the propriety of approving this motion in terms of your own professional judgment?
I don't disagree because the finding is a disclosure finding, and that's the direction that we took it in. And the items that remained undisclosed are not significant. So in our opinion, the committee has materially complied by amending their reports.
And with respect, you have a second motion, too,
second,
and that's
motion.
What I'm wondering. Maybe we get the same comment now and just vote on both of them, or how do you feel about that?
Well, I'm breaking it out because I think this is the part that there's agreement on.
Right.
But the crux of the issue for me is that the recommendation with respect to the rest of it, and that'll be the second motion, is inconsistent with both the recommendation in the Kansas Republican Party audit of last year, and my vote in the, and yours as well in that case. So I'm the purpose of my motion is to approve what is consistent with what we did last year, and to propose something else that would be consistent with what we did last year. I suspect that the first motion will garner a majority vote, and the second one won't, but that's life.
Any other comments on the motion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it 6-0. Are there any other motions? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With respect to the recommendation with respect to finding 3A, I move that pertaining to administrative costs, $48,520, payroll and associated costs, $14,999, and printed materials, $11,500. I move that we approve a finding that the Maine Republican Party made potentially federal or allocable expenses from a non-federal account in the amount of $75,019, which required reporting. And just by way of explanation, that is exactly the recommendation that was made in analogous circumstances in the Kansas case, and I'm just trying to conform this to that.
Any comments or questions on the motion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. The motion fails 3-3.
Do you need anything else? No, we're good.
I think that we're good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will, as noted by the agenda, we will not be considering the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on McCain-Palin 2008 today, but we will do so in the near future. Ms. Orrick, are there any management and administrative matters to discuss?
There are none.
Hearing none, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.